for the State of Nevada is now in session.
The Honorable Chief Justice Herndon presiding.
Welcome, be seated, please. All right, this is the time set for argument in docket number 89958. Are both sides ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yep.
Yes.
Does appellant wish to retain any time for rebuttal?
2 minutes, please.
Okay, you can approach the podium and get started when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Mark Scifalacqua and Sam Bateman on behalf of the appellant, City of Henderson. Your Honors, the issue before this court today is one of balance. Balance between the branches of government, balance between the constitutional rights of defendants and victims, and balance in the obligations imposed on prosecuting agencies across our state. NRS 178-4849 offends the delicate balance this court struck in Valdez-Jimenez. That balance should once again be restored, and the district court reversed for two reasons. First, separation of powers. When bail hearings are held is a decision for our judges, not our lawmakers. Accordingly, a law that forces the judiciary to act in a fixed time frame is only valid if the judiciary agrees to it. That never happened here. In Valdez-Jimenez, however, this court did sanction and endorse a statutory scheme of having hearings within 72 hours, excluding non-judicial days. It had been followed by over 40 years by your limited jurisdiction courts, and it worked. After your decision, though, the legislature changed that time frame that you authorized to 48 calendar hours statewide. This did not comport with your decision and does not always allow enough time for the risk assessment to be prepared and considered by your judges at bail hearings. And second, Marcy's Law. Victims need a reasonable amount of time to assert their rights at bail hearings, and that's not occurring. Marcy's Law only allows the legislature to enact laws that help and protect victims' rights. This law unquestionably diminishes their rights. And lastly, Your Honors, this unreasonable time frame directly interferes with the core duties of a prosecutor to seek justice and to represent the compelling interests of the community at bail hearings, and that was not the case under the prior framework. We are going to ask the court to reverse and to uphold the balance you struck between these very delicate and important rights in the Valdez decision. I would take a pause and answer any questions the court may have of me today.
So we want to talk about standing.
Yes.
So the city's alleged injury does not really arise out of any unconstitutional conduct on the part of the named defendants, because the defendants are not charged with enforcing or taking any action with respect to Marcy's Law. So how do you, the traceability, the redressability, how do we get there?
Of course, Your Honor. Anytime the process, the court process is undermined, the integrity and the fairness of the court process is undermined, the prosecutor will be injured. It is our job to guard the process. That's why we have higher ethical duties, as you know, than any other lawyer. So what this law does is interfere with our interests, one, to meet our burden. So we have the clear and convincing burden of proof. We have less time, less opportunity to get to that burden. And so our interest is in protecting the community. That can be sacrificed. And the second part is our job is to do justice. If we believe a law is interfering with a constitutional right of anyone, we are allowed to bring that up. And frankly, not just can we, I believe we should bring
that up. The language of the statute confers standing on the victims directly. There's no language, as in other jurisdictions, that confers jurisdiction on the prosecutor. So how do we get there?
That's fair, Your Honor. It does say in Marcy's Law the victim has standing to assert their rights in court, in the trial court it's really referring to. That is not exactly what I was doing in the below cases. What I was doing in simply bringing up, Your Honors, they haven't had enough time to assert their Marcy's Law rights. It does say in Marcy's Law the prosecutor has the same authority and duties as they've always had. It doesn't change their authority or duties. Part of the prosecutor's authority, make sure everyone's constitutional rights are being followed. That's why we're able to bring this up.
Have you had victims come up to you and say, we didn't have enough time to do this, or are you just
kind of hypothecating that they aren't going to have enough time given the times.
I think that comes from a little bit of the data we collected, Your Honor. You know, over 50% of victims we can't reach in this time frame. The reason is, you know, it says 48 hours, obviously, in the statute, hard hours. But it never means that because of how arrests fall in the middle of the night. And, you know, you can't always have a hearing right at the 47th hour. So the data shows we're doing this at 24 or under. To answer your question directly, though, yes, victims sometimes do talk to us in a reasonable time frame. The victims in this case did talk to us in a reasonable time frame the following week. So it was information that could have been incorporated perhaps into argument or how the prosecutor is going to handle the case.
You're presenting it as it's a pervasive issue, and so that's what I'm trying to get an idea of. How pervasive is it that a victim will say, I didn't have enough time? Or, you know, suppose you have 72 hours or more hours than that. I'm sure there's victims that you can't find, even within that time period.
And that's fair, Your Honor. Not every victim will participate in a prosecution. Many will, but many won't, and you're absolutely right. My point is this, they have to have a chance, and they don't necessarily have that chance in this type of a time frame. When we do hear from victims, if they are requesting something else, yes, we can sometimes put those cases back on calendar, but the problem is the bail hearing's already occurred. It's over. Their right to say something to the prosecutor or to the court if they wanted the time has really evaporated. So their right's gone before they already are.
What kind of time frame would you propose, if any?
Your Honor, I think the court hit the proverbial sweet spot with 171, 178. It's the 72, so it's really three business days because you take out the non-business days.
So is that going to make a substantial difference between 48 hours and 72 hours, having one extra day to contact them?
I think so, Your Honor, because it ultimately comes more than one extra day because of the non-judicial days that are taken out of the 72, but they're not taken out for the 48. So there's some more time in there. I think the real trouble we run into, Your Honor, when you say 48, we're really getting a lot closer to the 24 or under. That same day of arrest, that is too hard for a victim generally to come to court. There's so much going on in a victim's life. And so I do think that extra day means a world of difference, and that's extra information.
Mr. Scifalacco, it seems like that is a problem not of this law's making. Like, if the law allows it up to 48 hours, the fact that you're choosing, not you, the court, is choosing to have them in 12 or 24 hours, and that causes additional problems, is not a problem caused by the statute, is it?
I think it's exactly caused by the statute, if I could explain.
Yeah.
The only way to make this more meaningful is if you had it way at the back end of the 48, all right? So it's not the same day of arrest. The defendant's able to participate, the victim's able to participate, prosecutor can put on a cogent case and meet their burden. The problem with that, Your Honor, is, as you know, I can't tell the courts when to operate. And
yes.
And so here's the issue. Under Sparks, that's up to them. You know, they have staffs, they need staff to operate. Many can't run like the Las Vegas Justice.
Sure, but my point, of course, the court is going to decide when it schedules it within its schedule. We understand that, but that comes back to the problem of whether all of this makes the statute, where the legislature weighed different considerations, and I mean, whether they're right or wrong, that they get to make policy choices. So is this problem caused by their policy choice or the court's scheduling preferences?
Right. I think there is some tension there because my position is the legislature really shouldn't be doing this in the first place without judicial approval. There is that.
But you like NRS 171.178, which is also a legislative act.
It absolutely is. And my whole point is, in Valdez-Jimenez, when you said we could have it at the initial appearance, everybody knew what that meant. And so that is a sanctioning, in my opinion, of this is an appropriate time frame. Doesn't have to happen the same day of arrest. We give our limited jurisdiction courts a little more breathing room. The only way to get to where you're saying is of having some more time is really to have the courts operate every single day so you could get it at the very end of the 48.
How often do you request a continuance for good cause?
You know, it's a not to use good again, but it's a good question. It depends on the case. Sometimes You will ask for a continuance on good cause, and sometimes not, Your Honor. Sometimes you're so concerned about the victim that you'll just argue it anyway because you're asking for a higher bail. So
you have that mechanism available.
We do have that mechanism available, Your Honor. I would say a little bit like the statute you invalidated in Valdez-Jimenez, it puts the cart before the horse. The good cause I'm asking for is simply some more time to make sure the Constitution's complied with. Make sure the victim has a reasonable amount of time to participate if they want, and to have the risk assessment. So I'm really just asking for good cause to comply with either a court order or, as I see, the constitutional right, and that would not be appropriate. And the problem there is it's when you ask for good cause, it's nothing I really caused myself. You know, it's not as though my witness is unavailable necessarily, or it's the time frame. It's the same good cause. And so you're very unlikely to get a good cause continuance because, frankly, I sound like a broken record.
Well, but the statute allows the court to do it essentially on its own as well.
That is more than fair.
If the court says, look, I'm dealing with a violent sexual assault, and my understanding is the victim is hospitalized and had surgery and is unavailable right now, and we don't even have a pretrial risk assessment tool done yet. I want those things before I make this very important decision, so I'm going to continue this over for a day or whatever it may be. It doesn't have to be at the request of the party. The court can sua sponte make that finding as well, right?
You are correct. They are able to do that.
So it's not really a hard 48 hours. There are mechanisms in there for parties and the court to say, we need a little more time to do this right, not do it fast.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. I do think, though, that it's one of the things where the practicality, I think, runs against that sometime. As you know, these hearings are now happening on the weekends.
Right.
You know, everybody's there. You know, when we're asking for that many continuances, I think there's just a practical issue with how courts operate of, you know, yes, they could do that on the one-off. Are they going to do that on 75% of their cases when they have all the parties and the staff there? Likely not. And so that's why it's not always the greatest mechanism to consistently comply with.
Well, no, but like if you make a record about why there is good cause and the court instead denies good cause, then you could, I mean, I realize there's short time frames, mm-hmm. but you can try to seek appellate remedies, for example, if, you know, to say, look, you know, we showed good cause, this is good cause, and yet we're being routinely denied, you know, court review this.
Sure. And that, I think, is what I'm doing somewhat with this appeal, Your Honor. I think it's difficult because the prosecutor really doesn't have an independent right to appeal losing a motion to continue mid-case. It
would have to be a writ.
It would have to be a writ. You're absolutely right. And I think I'd have to show the court was arbitrary and capricious, but frankly, I understand what the court's going through. They have all these cases. They can't continue them all. And so I don't know if I'd meet that standard.
But counsel, I just want to understand, because Marcy's Law is littered with reasonableness.
Yes.
And there's upon request. So it puts the onus on the victim to reach out, because many of these rights are triggered by their request.
Yes.
And then I think the one that we're talking about is reasonable notice, right?
Yes.
So we're not really talking about court days. I mean, the concern for everybody is weekends. Because when the 48 hours kicked in, and they were a real 48 hours, courts flipped, DA's offices flipped, and defense bar flipped because nobody's working on weekends. And now suddenly, and that's not to say people aren't committed or whatever, but they have staffs and you have bailiffs, and there was all these other costs associated with it. But on a reasonable notice, if you have a police report and a victim has, there's a phone number or something, you call it, and whether you connect with somebody or not, I would suspect that that's probably reasonable notice that there's going to be a hearing. Because the flip side is, how many days should a defendant languish while you make attempts to have actual conversation with a victim at a bail hearing, which is not necessarily even contemplated by Marcy's Law?
Yeah.
So that's where I'm struggling.
No, I think that's a great question. I think that you're right. There was trouble when we went from judicial to non-judicial. And when we do that, my understanding of Lindauer, that should have been consented to by this court, either in the political process or through a decision. That aside, yes, there is a little more flexibility on judicial days than there is on the non-judicial days. Because as you mentioned, courts, if I could just say Vegas, Henderson, North Las Vegas, and Reno, our four biggest cities, none of them are operating 4 day a week, or I'm sorry, 7 day a week court, like say the Las Vegas Justice Court is. So even those jurisdictions with their abilities can't do that. And so my point is, you're really just going to get these tight time frames over and over again. Yes. The reason why is why I think the three business day worked better. I agree there should be a limit, and I think there was that limit under 171, 178 with the initial appearance framework. So we're not talking 2 weeks, but I'm not talking 2 hours either. That's not going to work for an adversarial hearing. As far as getting a hold of the victim, the problem is when you have these tight arrest to calendar ratios that we've been seeing, it's very hard to get that notice.
Well, two things. One, the obligation is reasonable notice.
Yes.
So you do the best you can. And any deficiencies in contacting victims, you know, it's where this gets corrected as opposed to being corrected here and validating the provision. You know, maybe law enforcement should have a card they hand out. This is the court it's going to go to. This is the phone number for the prosecutor, because Marcy's Law does put the onus on the victim to make requests.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, please.
Oh, and I think that would be a great law. May I finish my thought, Your Honor? I think that would be a great law. Here's the problem.
You're not out of time.
Oh, that's right. I just left. Marcy's Law, I think, says that we're able to, you know, have reasonable notice. What is that going to be? I think overall, Your Honor, though, they do have a right to have the voice. I think that gets really tight in those time frames, and I just don't believe it's reasonable. If I could reserve my balance. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Yasmin Kayami, and this is Lance Meningo, and we represent the respondents in this matter. Pretrial liberty of the accused is so vastly important that this very court has referred to it as a fundamental constitutional right. In 2020, this court in Valdez-Jimenez held that substantive due process requires that arrestees are entitled to a prompt, individualized hearing to address their custody status. However, this court did not mandate a specific time period in which a bail hearing must occur after arrest. After Valdez-Jimenez, the legislature, after careful consideration, hearings, research, and input from elected officials, judges, and stakeholders, enacted NRS 178-4849, determining that to be prompt, a bail hearing must be conducted within 48 hours after arrest. In addition, the legislature included a built-in exception to the 48-hour rule in which a bail hearing can be continued by any party upon a showing of good cause. The city argues that the 48-hour rule is unconstitutional because its time requirement is rushed and thus violates Marcy's Law and the separation of powers. There are two main issues with the city's arguments. First, the law does not support them. And second, there is no jurisdiction for the city to raise them. We ask this court affirm the district court's ruling. And with the court's permission, I will turn to my arguments. There are two main parts to our argument, justiciability and the merits. But as there's some overlap between the merits in this case and our arguments regarding the city's lack of injury with respect to standing, with the court's permission, I'm going to begin with the merits. NRS 178-4849 does not violate Marcy's Law. Nothing about the 48-hour timeline requirement directly violates any section of Marcy's Law or makes it invalid under any circumstance. The language of Marcy's Law is clear and unambiguous. The city argues in its briefing that the 48-hour timeline violates victims' rights because it does not give them a reasonable opportunity to be notified of, attend, and be heard at bail hearings, or to be protected from the defendants or confer with the prosecutor. The city improperly conflates the distinct rights enumerated in Marcy's Law, treating them as automatic and simultaneous, but they are not. Specifically, Section 8A1C requires that a victim has the right to have their safety and the safety of their family considered when the court is fixing the amount of bail and release conditions for the defendant. But it doesn't provide guidance on
how. Can I interrupt? I'm
sorry. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Just in terms of standing, I want to go back to the standing issue because that's a threshold determination. So we held in the Nevada State versus Nevada Board of Pardons that the Washoe County DA's office had standing to raise Marcy Law when challenging this blanket agenda item addressing whether to commute all of the death sentence death cases to life without the possibility of parole. And there we held that the DA's role in advocating for victims and protecting the integrity of criminal convictions as well as corresponding sentences was enough to confer standing. So how is this different in terms of the Henderson City Attorney's Office having standing?
So in this case, Marcy's law specifically provides standing to the victims. And so there's no question of whether the victims can have standing to...
But to the exclusion of everybody else? Or is it just saying you have standing, but nobody else has standing except for the victims? I didn't see that language in there.
So it just says that victims do have standing. And I think the issue here really is a hindrance on their ability to bring this case. So obviously, if there was a victim, and we know in the last 3 years, there has not been one named victim identified that has come forward and said, hey, this 48-hour rule has violated my Marcy's Law rights. If that were the case, if there was a victim, then that victim under Marcy's Law would have the right to then bring an action to compel the city or the prosecutor to follow their rights.
But under a third-party standing, is it likely that they would do so? I mean, are they informed? I mean, how would they know to do that? And there's no process set forth in the law, so maybe it's not self-executing. I don't know. It's a debate. There's no process in the law that explains how victims can then go through and formally assert their rights. So like, how do we deal with that?
So Marcy's Law does give a little bit of guidance because it says that they're able to compel the city. So my understanding would be that they would have the standing in that case to bring forth an action in front of the court. We see this all the time with respect to no contact orders. Oftentimes victims don't want a no contact order, so later they'll actually go file their own motion within that case and make representations as to why they believe the no contact order should be vacated. So I think it would be the same process, as they would have the right to say, my rights are violated in this case, I want to be heard by the court, and the court, pursuant to Marcy's Law, has to make a timely decision on that.
But there's no guidance in terms of how they would do that. So if I've just been victimized, how do I know to do all of these things? Like, what is there's no procedure.
Right. And so Marcy's Law doesn't actually lay out a proper procedure for them to do it. But
it's not self-executing?
I would say it is not self-executing because it doesn't tell you how these rights should follow through.
Okay.
And so I think that's part of the issue.
Right.
And that kind of goes to the section C about how the safety of the victim would be considered at a bail hearing. It also doesn't tell us how that needs to happen. But what we do know based on the language of Marcy's Law is there's no duty on anybody, the city, the prosecutor, the court, anyone to reach out to a victim and get direct input. Mm-hmm.
Counsel, since we're at kind of threshold questions, can you address whether or not the municipal court can invalidate a state statute on constitutional grounds?
Sure. So there's a lot of case law in this area that we cited to in our briefings, specifically McKay versus City of Las Vegas. In that court, in that case, the court held that municipal court judges have no power to declare state law unconstitutional. That was later then narrowed in McKay, which said that justice courts do have express authority to consider some constitutional issues with respect to cases in front of them.
Well, constitutional issue is different than invalidating a statute.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so our argument here is, obviously the municipal court can hear constitutional issues. If there's a motion because there's a bad search, that judge is going to have to be able to make a decision and not send it up to the district court. However, the authority does not extend to allowing the municipal court to then declare a state law unconstitutional. This statute is not a misdemeanor, and so the municipal court does not have jurisdiction over it. It affects all of those in the state of Nevada outside of Henderson city limits, and it affects those charged with gross misdemeanors and felonies. And so I know one of the arguments has been, well, obviously our court doesn't bind on higher courts, but then we're going to have an issue where municipal courts essentially make their own procedural rules and ignore the law of the state.
Can I just go back to standing? I'm really
sure.
Stuck. This is what my sticking point is on standing. Would this fall within the public importance exception for standing? If we found that there was no direct standing, no third-party standing, would then the public importance exception apply?
So two things. So this wasn't really addressed in the city's brief. It was a footnote. And then later, I know Amiki addressed this heavily, and Aramiki also responded. So I'm going to rely on those arguments. But essentially, no, because the plaintiffs do not seek to enforce a public official's compliance with a public duty pursuant to the separation of powers. That is, declaring this statute unconstitutional doesn't enforce a public official's compliance with a public duty. If it's meant to be the municipal court judge and the public duty is completion of a risk assessment, declaring the statute unconstitutional does not entail this result. We actually saw this in this case. Mr. Armendariz had a hearing. He was arrested. And the court, sua sponte, like Justice Herndon said, continued it to the next day because they wanted a Nevada pretrial risk assessment done. So everyone comes back the next day, still not done. And so I think invalidating the statute, giving more time, doesn't necessarily redress the issues that the city has, and in fact causes defendants who are innocent to languish in jail for a longer period of time with no guarantee that things are going to be completed, that victims are going to be reached by continuing the hearing and giving more time to the city. Also, importantly, we kind of touched upon this, but the plain language of Marcy's Law doesn't require actual victim input. It doesn't require contact. And most importantly, the legislature included a built-in exception to this. They said, hey, if there's an issue and it needs to be fleshed out, whether it's from the defense standpoint, the prosecution, or the court, we can continue this hearing upon a showing of good cause. With respect to separation of powers, kind of similar arguments, there's no actual conflict here between the 48-hour rule and ADKT 0539. Nothing in the language makes it impossible. And the city collected data from January 1st, 2023 until September of 2023. And they said that they had Nevada pretrial assessments prepared before court 86.5% of the time. And so that's not nothing. That's almost all of the time they're getting these pretrial risk assessments. And again, the ADKT it tells the court that they need to consider these things for uniformity purposes. And so they're getting them done most of the time, and the built-in exception would then allow them to ask for a continuance if they believe that they need that to move forward with the bail hearing.
But do you think Marcy's Law is a procedural rule such that we should view it through the lens of Lindauer? Should the legislature be telling the courts how much time they should be setting for these bail hearings?
I just want to clarify. So Marcy's Law, you're asking if Marcy's Law should be a procedural rule?
Right.
I would argue that Marcy's Law is substantive because it's giving rights to victims. So I don't believe that it's a procedural rule. And in addition, there's no conflict because the language of the statute is that you need to have this bail hearing within 48 hours. Nothing about that prevents a victim from making a request to be heard, from making a request to confer with the prosecutor, or from having their safety considered. And our arguments have been that safety can be considered through a plethora of different factors or ways by the court.
And it doesn't conflict with ADKT or our Valdez-Jimenez case.
Right, because there's just no conflict.
Right.
In Valdez-Jimenez, this court said, you know, we believe that substantive due process requires a prompt hearing, and the legislature just said, we believe prompt is 48, and that was after careful consideration.
Does it matter that the 48-hour period seems to be on the low end in terms of a national, like a national application, where the 48 hours is one of the quickest turnaround times?
I think good for us. I mean, I think that we're doing something right. I did research other states. It looks like Alaska might also have a 48-hour rule, and so with that, I think that's a good thing for us. I think that it was kind of a middle ground because the defense bar wanted 24 hours. And so I think that was kind of where we settled, where we were like, okay, this is the right amount of time for everyone to be prepared for this hearing. And also so that someone who's innocent doesn't languish in jail unnecessarily, because as we know, the consequences of sitting in jail are you could lose your family, your house, your pets. It's really serious, and so I think that's why we ended up getting to that number.
And counsel, it wasn't, I mean, it ended up not being 72 judicial days, because if you got picked up on a Wednesday later, you'd be sitting till Monday.
Right.
And so 3 days becomes 5 days, or in some instances, 6 days. So there was definitely a concern.
Right.
Thank you.
And that's also what happened in this case. We know that two of the respondents here didn't have bail hearings, because after the Henderson Municipal Court, after Judge Burr issued the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the court vacated some bail hearings, and respondent Dooley and Hardy never actually had a bail hearing, and then they sat in jail for 4 days until their hearing. The other thing too is I think
So they had one after the 4 days.
Technically, no. My understanding was that they actually ended up negotiating their cases on that Monday, so it was never necessary at that point, but they did sit. And the important part about those two actually is that respondent Dooley had a Nevada pretrial risk assessment done. He scored a low score of a 4. So there was actually a chance that the court would have released him on OR on Thursday, but instead he sat till Monday. And the other respondent, Jacob Hardy, he had a victimless crime, so there was no Marcy's Law issue, and he had a pretrial risk assessment. So both of those things were done, and he sat.
So if somebody got released by the court because at the time of this initial hearing, determined, you know, that there's no reason why they have to have bail, so they're OR'd with whatever conditions are imposed. And after that, the prosecutor gets some additional information that shows, oh, there's more of a risk here than we realized, information we didn't have at the time of the hearing. Is there a way for them to put it up back on calendar and get the court to reconsider their custody status?
Yes, so you can, and that was one of our arguments as well, is you can later, if you have more information, you can then ask to readdress custody status. And we see that happen all the time. Unfortunately, if someone picks up a new case, that happens where the prosecutor will file a motion and ask to readdress custody status. And so in addition to the built-in remedy to continue the hearing, we also have the remedy that if there is new information learned later, that we can readdress custody status before the court.
Can I ask you a question just hypothetically toward the merits, mm-hmm. since you have one more time?
Sure.
It would, hypothetically, would a if a prosecutor's office said at bail hearings, so at arrest, absent a request from the victim, we're not even going to try to notify anybody about this bail hearing, because the Constitution says upon request, they're entitled to reasonable notice. They haven't had any request. If that was their policy, would there be a problem with that?
Potentially, but I believe Marcy's Law, actually, the last section, Q, mm-hmm. states that, and I can't find it, court's indulgence. Section Q says that victims have the right to specifically be informed of the rights enumerated in this section and to have information concerning those rights be made available to the general public. Other states usually do that by publication, but they can post about it on their website. And as you said earlier, they can actually have law enforcement give out a card upon contact with victims and say, hey, here's the card. This is 48 hours actually gives more certainty. This bail hearing is going to be conducted within 48 hours. This is the court it's going to go to. Here's the website. Here's a victim advocate. And so that way, then, they have reasonable notice. And I believe that's my time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
So, Your Honors, the district court order, as you can see, said that it's up to the legislature to set a time frame for when these bail hearings occur. I would ask that not stand. That is not true. That would overturn some of your prior case law. This court can make a decision about when you would like bail hearings, but that is not something that should be transferred to the legislature, because simply there could be no end in sight.
Even if we look at that as the legislature kind of trampling a little bit into judicial procedural functions, how does it conflict? How does it make Valdez Jimenez or the ADKT somehow inapplicable? Can't they exist harmoniously?
I don't think in practicality, because of when calendars are being scheduled in our state and the constrictions that courts have to have court, not having court every single day. So because there's no timeframes carved out and it's a hard 48, we're really running into the same day of arrest. And that's when we have problems. I appreciated what you said about the maybe the police giving out a something in the field. You know, that sounds like a great law. That's the problem with Marcy's law. The legislature, in my opinion, these are individual rights. This court said it, they're individual rights. If they're going to restrict individual rights in a way, they better create some offset laws statewide to give victims notice, to give victims the ability to speak, to talk to the prosecutor, to get to court. They didn't do any of that. All they did was restrict the time frame, and many times cutting it in half or more so. So we're all trying to do our best.
And I agree with that. I just want to understand. This is really a weekend problem. It's not a Monday problem or a Tuesday problem because they have court and all the mechanisms are in place. This is a get picked up on a Friday or a Saturday or a Sunday. Because I just want to understand really where the, if it was 48 hours, but it was 48 hours judicial days, would we be having this conversation?
You could save the statute that way. I agree.
I'm just curious.
All right. Last thing I would just mention, is that okay? Or to follow up on that. As you can see from the amicus, this is happening everywhere. It's not just a Henderson problem. I know we talked a lot about Henderson today. We have some of the biggest counties and the smallest counties as far as their DA's office joining in. This isn't working in Henderson, but it's really not working anywhere. And I don't see how it could with how courts are staffed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And thank you to both sides. Interesting issues. Appreciate the briefing and the arguments today. The matter is going to stand submitted to the court, and we will be in recess until our next call. Thank you.
All rise.